Are you loving what you're hearing? Well, the establishment hates it, and right now they're conjuring up new ways to try and censor RCR. To ensure you never miss a beat of the hard-hitting news you've come to know and love, make sure you're on the RCR mailing list. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.
Welcome back to the weekly roundup on the Dialogue with Dewa De Boer and William McGimpsey on Reality Check Radio, where we discuss the happenings of the week in New Zealand and abroad. And I will ask William a few questions as well. The segment that we did 2 weeks back was very popular, and the management have asked if we would do this weekly. So we're taking up that challenge starting now. Welcome back to the show, William.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on. An honor to join you, as always.
I'm going to get right into it. Following up from last time, which is not quite last week, 2 weeks ago, though, but I think that's fine. Could we get a few updates on some of the things that we talked about then? The first being the Inflection Point NZ conference, which you attended. We talked about it at the time, that it was under a bit of a threat from Wellington officials, but it went ahead. As far as I can tell, it was a success. Perhaps you can let us know a little bit about the conference and the aftermath.
Yeah, well, it was a very successful conference, I think. Very professionally run. It had about 10 speakers, all speaking on various aspects of trans or gender ideology and the harms that it causes. And, you know, the harms, obviously, they ranged from, you know, like puberty blockers, cross-sex hormones, the horrible surgical mutilation that can occur to kids, and then the mental harms side of it. But there's also other speakers such as Roe Edge, who talked about the problems that it creates for women's sports having to compete against male athletes, more biologically male athletes, which is not only unfair because the testosterone obviously gives... even if you don't have a higher testosterone now, if you're on female hormones, the fact that you had high testosterone in the past or went through male puberty still gives you massive advantages, massive physical advantages. Yeah, you're larger, you're stronger, you have stronger bones, and it can actually be dangerous. It's not just an unfair competitive advantage. In contact sports particularly, it can be dangerous for a woman in those situations. And yeah, there were other speakers. Di Landy spoke. She gave a really interesting speech about how there's an attempt to weave gender ideology and Maori culture together, which she thought was a sort of disingenuous misappropriation of Maori culture, and that, you know, gender ideology doesn't really exist in any type of traditional Maori culture. It was called Inflection Point, and I think that theme came through quite strongly. Bob McCroskey from Family First gave an overview of some of the statistics around public perception to various aspects of gender ideology. And his presentation showed quite clearly that the public tolerance, the public mood, the public support for gender ideology has reversed and is going back the other way. It's actually becoming less popular with the public over time. Now, on all the measures, or at least a majority of them that Bob outlined, the public opposes gender ideology now. So there was a real feeling that the public mood has turned on the gender ideologues. And the problem is that it's, you know, we've perhaps won the public mood, but our ideological opponents have all the institutional power and still the majority of politicians, I think, and parties on their side. So that the next stage of the battle, so to speak, will be to try and overcome those challenges. So that's a wee bit of the substance. I did a large tweet thread, live reporting from the conference that a lot of people seem to think was popular and valuable. I think what, in some quarters at least, overshadowed the content of the conference was some of the shenanigans that went on. There was a mob of trans protesters outside the conference, and they threw some sort of a stink bomb, or, you know, it contained, might have contained human excrement. There's some debate over that, but it certainly was very smelly, and it splattered on some police and security guards outside the conference. So that created a bit of a storm. There was some petty and vindictive things done by the managers of the venue, which has been reported in the aftermath. So the Inflection Point organizers worked very hard right up until the night before the conference to make sure that the cafe downstairs was open so that people would be able to go and get snacks without having to go and confront the mob of trans protesters outside. And they were assured that it would be open. And yet when they turned up in the morning, they found that it had been closed. So nevertheless, I went and got lunch at about 1 or 2 o'clock, and I never ran into the trans protesters. And I think most of us did the same. So it didn't turn out to be much of a problem. But they also did several other petty and vindictive things. They removed the toilet paper from the soap from the women's toilets. And they removed all the cups from the water dispensers. A whole lot of silly little things like that, which, although the event got to go ahead, they did try and make it as miserable as possible. But one thing that's happened since then is Winston Peters and New Zealand First have kicked off the process of passing a new free speech bill, which will deal to the problem of the thugs veto. The thugs veto being the problem of people denying speakers and events a venue, or shutting down the venue through protest, so that the speech or the message they want to deliver can't be delivered. So this new bill aims to combat that and make it illegal for controversial speakers to be denied the use of public venues. And so that's very timely, and I hope that passes, and that will hopefully prevent controversial events like this from being shut down in future, and other events, you know, like Posey Parker's speech and things like that. Hopefully this bill will enable things like that not to be shut down.
This actually started with Lawrence Southern and Stefan Molyneux trying to visit New Zealand many years ago, and I want to say 2019. My memory may be a little bit faulty. It was a long time ago. And they had a public venue that cancelled, and that caused a chain reaction of all kinds of other horrible things to happen. So that was the first moment that I remember of this modern free speech wars and public venues being threatened and being withheld by councils. And it's great to see a piece of legislation now coming before Parliament to actually address that problem, and then to say, hey, if people holding events, making speeches, they can hire public venues, and they're not going to be at risk of ideologues pulling the rug on these venues and on these events. So that's great news. That's a good item to open this segment with. Some positive news in between all of the literal muck that you had to go through.
Yeah, now, well, the if I just add a little point to that, that the Stefan Molyneux and Lauren Southern cancellings was the impetus, if I recall correctly, for the Free Speech Union to be set up in the beginning. And this legislation that New Zealand First has introduced was actually draft legislation prepared by the Free Speech Union. So they deserve credit, I think, for doing this work and getting it introduced to Parliament.
That reminds me, if any of the listeners would like an interview with Stefan Molyneux or Lawrence Southern, could try and arrange that for the show. I know Lawrence Southern's a bit harder to get a hold of, but perhaps Stefan Molyneux can come on, and I can tell him that he's got some legislation in his honour that's going through New Zealand Parliament at the moment.
I'm now, sure you're happy about that.
I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it. So another quick follow-up as well here. We talked about Australia's e-safety commissioner taking on Elon Musk and X 2 weeks ago, that they sort of lost, although they're making some kind of appeals that will take a long time to get through. There's been another development now with them spying on some of their critics.
Well, it's been revealed that they've employed a social listening company that is tracking criticism of the eSafety Commission on Twitter and providing reports about this criticism in real time to the eSafety Commission. And we know through some of the documents that have been revealed in some of the hearings that they're sort of reading this stuff right throughout the day in real time as the reports are being delivered to them. But what makes this especially hypocritical is that during some of the hearings they've been involved in against X, they've petitioned the judge to suppress details of their own activities and their own employees from being monitored and tracked in the same way. So that they want to spy on their critics and prevent their critics from investigating and figuring out things about them and how their organization works. And what I would say is that this isn't really the behavior of public servants, of people who are there to serve the public. This is more reminiscent of the behavior of foreign spies who try to track the behavior of their enemies and cover up any knowledge or information about their own behavior. And this sort of illustrates a lot of the turn that's happened in the behavior of Western governments towards their own populations. So they've started to view them in many ways as hostile entities who have to be tracked and monitored and kept in their place. And I don't think that's a very good development.
No, it is not. Hopefully the Australians have a little bit of luck reining that in, sort of like we have in New Zealand. We talked 2 weeks ago about the Christchurch Call Foundation being created and supposedly no longer being funded by the government. But we've had another development there in the past week as well that seems like the sources of funding are not being transparently revealed. Like they've said, there's no government funding, but they won't actually confirm that. And some Information Act requests have been made to the Department of the Prime Minister.
Simon Anderson on Twitter has apparently lodged an Official Information Act request, or if he didn't lodge it, he's at least reporting on it on Twitter, asking about what the sources of funding for the new Christchurch Call Foundation are. And the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet is refusing to say what all the sources of funding for the new Christchurch Call Foundation are. Part of the reason is because they think it will prejudice future funding. So I'm not sure exactly what we can read into that, but we were told, you know, this is going to be a private foundation, and now they're not revealing where all the sources of funding are coming from. And I think what's useful to bear in mind here is that part of the Ardern government strategy for dealing with, you know, misinformation and disinformation was to set up groups at arm's length from government that really government was involved in and talked to, but looked like they were non-government entities. And they wanted to do that to avoid giving the impression they were setting up an Orwellian sort of system for controlling the political debate, but which of course is exactly what they were trying to do. So this refusal to reveal the funding sources sort of fits into that acknowledged model of what the Ardern government was trying to do.
Well, thank you for those updates. And I'm going to get into an even more controversial subject now. In the lead up to the budget announcement yesterday, for the past week, the Māori Party, or Te Pāti Māori, have been amped up their rhetoric for days and days on end. And I want to focus on just particularly on the rhetoric side of this. So they started off by calling for strikes, calling for all, and like an ethnic strike, calling for Māori to take strikes. They released propaganda videos and images with guns and saying that if all Māori worked together, that they could bring down any government if they were all working together in ethnic solidarity. You've got the leader of the party saying that they need to start a new parliament for Māori, and also basically rejecting, it sounds like just rejecting the government, the legal system, just everything, by saying, oh, this is a Pākehā government with Pākehā laws and a Pākehā budget. All of this rhetoric just seems completely off the charts, crazy to me. Like, is it a clown show, or is this something that should be taken seriously from these guys?
Well, it's a little bit of both, isn't it? It is a bit clownish, but I think it gets a lot of attention. And so, I mean, it's dominating it dominated the political debate in the lead up to the budget. So you have to give them points for political messaging, I think. People may think it's distasteful, but it's working in terms of getting attention. What I would say about the strike thing is you can't go on strike just because you're Maori. You can take the day off and go on a protest, but you can't go on strike just because you're Maori. You have to have some sort of beef with your employer. You have to be, you know, negotiating wages or salaries and conditions. And that's what both Christopher Luxon and Chris Hipkins have said in response to the Maori Party's urging of all Maori to go on strike.
Yeah, it's almost like they were saying that the government is employing everyone. It feels like a very strange understanding of how society is structured, and this goes hand in hand with like what seems like their rejection of our entire society, and dismissing it and saying that it's Pākehā or colonial, like whatever terms that they use, but essentially all of the systems and structures and institutions that we have, they view as illegitimate. But then what? And that's the thing that I'm not hearing from them. Maybe it's not being reported on, but I don't think they're even addressing it, pointing to alternatives. Like, okay, well, what is it that you actually want? And the at least in the last week, I haven't seen or heard anything from anyone in the Maori Party saying, well, here's an example of a model that we want. Here's something that we built ourselves, or like that we're running on a small scale that's showing a new system that we want. And I do many interviews on the show, on the dialogue with people from different countries or even within New Zealand, perhaps, who are building something and putting it forward as a model. And there's nothing. Like it seems entirely bizarre and fake to me that it's purely complaining for the sake of complaining. And sure enough, you've said that it gets attention and we're talking about it, everybody's talking about it. But then what? Like, do they have a plan? Do you see a plan that they have to actually make some changes and build something different?
No, but they don't necessarily need that. For politicians, and the Maori Party aren't alone in this, for a politician, getting elected and maintaining power is priority number one. And then what you do after you get in power is a secondary priority. And I don't think they're the only politicians who are like that. But to be fair to them, there has been discussion and proposals from academics. I'm sort of going back in my mind now a wee way, but there were proposals around having an upper chamber in the New Zealand Parliament that would give iwi a different voice. There have been various proposals around constitutional changes or drafting a New Zealand constitution and how that would differ from the Treaty of Waitangi. So there are proposals floating around there, perhaps not by the Maori Party themselves, but by, you know, people who want a bit more independence for Maori.
Well, I guess that we're going to have to wait and see if there's an eventual situation then where the Maori Party ends up in some kind of coalition government, has some kind of power, and then we'll have to wait and see what kind of proposals they decide to put forward. That's not a very exciting thing for people listening, I think, but that may end up happening. Who knows? Now, a different angle here is the media. They sort of seem very hesitant to tackle what I tend to call ethno-nationalism, although that may be a bit generous by saying that there's ethno-nationalism. Some of it seems a bit more like ethno-narcissism. It's almost like it's being openly encouraged by the media. Any other ethnic group tries to do anything like this, you know, anywhere around the world almost, they get, you know, called all kinds of horrible names by the media. It's not allowed, completely forbidden. But when it's the Maori Party organizing this, speaking in this way, the media they're just too scared or unwilling or unable to give any kind of pushback or reasonable, or, you know, any kind of reasonable pushback at all.
Well, if you think back to your university education and your indoctrination about wokeness, you'll remember that the rules for the minority groups and the rules for the majority are very different. If you're a minority group in a white country, you know, you're oppressed and you get to play by a different set of rules. You're allowed to organise your politics along ethnic lines, and you're allowed to protest and campaign loudly for things that are in your ethnic interests, in your collective ethnic interests. But the same rules don't apply if you're in the white majority. If you're in the white majority, then, and you try and do that, the media will crack down on you like a ton of bricks. So those are the rules that seem to be in play right across the Western world. Doesn't seem fair. I don't think it's right. But that seems to be the rules that we're playing under at the moment.
I guess, yeah, being aware of those rules is a start. And, yeah, we'll have to see how this develops for them. Shifting gears just a little bit into government policy, we've had the repeal the previous Labour government amended their local body legislation to allow the establishment of Māori wards by local councils, and the National Part National Act New Zealand First Coalition is putting it back to how it was, where referendums have to be held on the establishment of Māori wards. We've now had dozens of mayors and even more councillors writing letters protesting to the government, saying that this is something that's impinging on their freedom, impinging on their democracy, because they made this decision as mayors and as councils, and they don't want to have to put it to their voters. What is this? Just is this a result of local politics being completely uninteresting to New Zealanders, and actually people realizing now how badly their local councils have been captured? Like, I guess the voters at a national level are voting for this particular policy, but then at the local body, at the local level, you've got mayors, councils that seem to be way more progressive in terms of not wanting people to have a say on the issue of Māori wards.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think we have a new government, and it's a more right-wing government, and left-wing elements from other parts of society, including local government, are looking for ways to undermine it and to, you know, fight back politically. And so what they've come up with here is they're writing a bunch of letters. I think 50 mayors and local council chair people have written letters, which One News has got a hold of somehow. I mean, the mayors and local chair people probably just told them.
They CC'd them into the letters.
Well, One News probably organised the letter writing campaign and said, you know, do you guys want to write some letters? We'll get you on TV. And this will be a good way to counter the government. I'm joking there. I don't have any evidence that One News did that. But yeah, 50 of them written these letters. And some of the language they're using is very ironic. They're saying it's undemocratic for a local referenda to be held on these Māori wards. So the way the legislation that the new government has kind of put through, how it works is, if you've introduced a Māori ward without a local sort of referendum in support of it, you have to run a new local referendum in 2025. And then if the people don't want it, you have to get rid of the Māori wards. And if they do want it, you can keep it. And so these mayors and local councils are saying that that process is undemocratic. It was democratic when the Māori wards got put in, according to them, without consulting the local population, but it's undemocratic when you take it out and that's what the local population wants. So that's backwards. They're also saying it's central government overreach to be doing this, which, of course, that's backwards too. It was central government overreach to put it in the first place. Giving the local populations a say on whether they want to keep it or not isn't overreach. That's giving power back to the people. So, I mean, all the language about this typical leftist fashion has been sort of reversed and bastardized, and they're using the opposite words to what they should be using to try and characterize it.
You were talking about power, like politicians wanting to hold on to power. This sounds like a very similar situation where these mayors, these councils had a particular power that they could exercise, and now that's being taken away from them and given directly to the people. And I guess, you know, nobody's happy about losing a particular power. And that seems to be, to me, the root of the problem here for them.
Yeah, it's the confluence of power and ideology, right? There's a lot of people who subscribe to the woke ideology, like we were talking about, that says you should give minority groups, and perhaps even particularly the Indigenous minority, more rights, more privileges than everyone else. And so a lot of people support it for those ideological reasons, along with the, you know, just having the power to do what you want, as you say.
Now, another coalition promise that the government has started to take action on is to repeal the treaty principles that have made their way into numerous pieces of legislation. And this was a core part of the campaign, I believe, for both ACT and New Zealand First, that all of these made-up treaty principles would have to go from legislation. And I don't even believe any of these bits of legislation define what the treaty principles are. They just say this act requires you to follow the treaty principles and then leaves that open for some judge to interpret as to what that treaty principles are. Perhaps you can fill in the audience as to the extent of the damage that's been done by these treaty principles.
Yeah, I used to work in a former life in the public sector, and it was a bit of a running joke. Yeah, you had to always, whenever you were writing any sort of paper or any bit of legislation, you always had to consult on what you always had to put a section in your paper about what the treaty principles said, and people would always try and sneak references to the treaty principles into new bits of legislation, despite them not being very well defined. But what's important to bear in mind here is there's two separate bits of work, one a New Zealand First policy, one an ACT policy. So ACT wants to pass a bill defining what the treaty principles are. New Zealand First wants to just remove and replace all references to treaty principles in law. And those two things are happening at the same time. What's interesting about that is ACT's bill won't really do much if all the references to the treaty principles are removed by the process New Zealand First has underway. So one uses released data very tactically, or not data, but released. I think they must have done OIA requests, or they've had a chat with a public servant who's trying to help them out. And they've been told that there's 40 pieces of legislation with references to the treaty principles that have been identified as part of this work program that they're then going to review and look to either remove references to the treaty principles from the legislation, or they're going to define exactly what the references to the treaty principles mean in the legislation itself. So it will remove that sort of element of subjectivity, and they're going to try and tie that right back to the treaty itself, which is, you know, that's the way it should work.
And ACT treaty principles, if they are passed, I believe that the idea was to put them to a referendum anyway, so there's no guarantee that, you know, they would get passed in that form. But I guess if they are put into law eventually, then the work that New Zealand First has done to replace the vague references to actual bits from the treaty itself, it does kind of match up to what ACT is trying to do there, because the treaty principles it wants to put forward are basically taken from the treaty, you know, in a very condensed form, and controversially so within
some. Yeah, well, if we don't get you with one way, we'll get you with the other way. So it's sort of a fail-safe. Both bits have to fail for the plan not to work.
And perhaps in some foolproof way as well, you know, as you've mentioned, the trying to sneak these things into legislation, the government is going to change at some stage in however many years, whether it's 3 years or 6 years or 9 years or 20 years, you get a different government. They may want to try and sneak these treaty principles in again. So it's definitely a worthwhile job at tackling this from multiple angles to kind of fortify your policy change for the long run.
Yeah, and what people need to be aware of in terms of these treaty principles is that these are, you know, they're made up by judges, and they diverge quite a lot from what the text of the treaty itself says. And they're used to justify a whole raft of policies towards Maori, which you really would struggle to see how the Treaty of Waitangi itself would allow that, or that the treaty would, you know, says that that's what you should do. And so there's something undemocratic about that, about judges making up laws or constitutional arrangements effectively that have a huge impact on the way New Zealand society runs. Big things like that ought to rest with the people of New Zealand and using the democratic process and through their elected representatives, and not be made by judges like that. Because if they do, you're going to run into the same problem that they had in America with abortion law, where laws preventing abortion were made up by judges effectively, who, you know, made up, which is what's, you know, specious reasoning that there's a right to abortion in the Constitution. And that had a serious flow-on effect in American politics for, you know, half a century. People felt it was undemocratic and unfair and forced on the population by judges. And what's happened with the treaty principles is the same sort of thing.
Now, another aspect that this government is digging into, quite literally, is mining, resource extraction. And again, this is a policy promise that's being delivered on. Both ACT and New Zealand First, I believe, wanted this oil and gas ban overturned and some form of resource extraction happening. There seems to be some pushback from environmentalists, as you would expect, going kind of, well, I say going ballistic, but they're doing the usual environmental protests and so on. What do you see in Shane Jones's big mining push? Is this mining resource extraction in New Zealand back for good, like in Australia, effectively, where the Australian economy is running on resource extraction? Or are we potentially looking at a bit of wasted opportunities again, where he gets a few projects running, and then in 3 years or 6 years or whatever, all of these things get shut down by a Labour Green government? Even if he does get all this mining off the ground, oil and gas exploration going, is all that money just going offshore to the companies that are extracting these resources, and the wealth of it is then, you know, disappears forever? Because it's a one-time use, these resources. Effectively, you get the money once, and then if you spend it, if you pour it into a budget deficit, or you allow the companies to take all of the profits, then that's it. The resources are gone.
Well, it's like everything with money, isn't it? You have to use it wisely. You have to save it and invest it and use the proceeds from it wisely. And some countries do this. Norway famously does this. It has a big sovereign wealth fund. It's filled up with money from its oil that it has around its coast. And it uses that money for economic development of Norway. And that's been a very successful scheme. And there are many other countries who do similar things. They exploit their mineral and oil wealth. They charge royalties to the companies who do the extraction. They place those royalties into sovereign wealth funds, which are invested, generate returns, and then they use those big funds for economic development and securing the welfare of their people. And so I think that would be what you would want to do long term. At the moment, New Zealand's mineral industry is a $1 billion in value export industry. And the plan that Shane Jones has unveiled is to double that by 2040, maybe. I can't quite remember the year off the top of my head, but to double the value. And this is in line with the National Party's strategy of doubling the total value of New Zealand's exports over the same time period. So the other thing to bear in mind here is that a lot of these industries, the mining, extraction industries, they're in the provinces. With the West Coast, for example, is a traditional mining area. That's where he unveiled the policy in Blackball. And these industries, they provide good jobs for people in those rural and provincial areas who live where the minerals are. And the people who often want to shut down the mineral exploitation are people who live in urban areas and are worried about the environmental effects. That can grate on people. If the local community, it should really be an issue for the local community, I think. If the local community is worried about the local environmental effects of mining or, you know, other activities like that, then I think it's fair enough if they have the choice to shut it down. But when people from elsewhere who never live in the area and don't come and see what happens there, if they impose their will on them from outside and stop them from using their own, exploiting their own mineral resources to give them jobs and wealth and a livelihood and to support the continued existence of their communities, that makes people angry. And we've had a lot of this sort of thing go on in New Zealand and in a lot of other places too, where urban people go to war against the industries that rural and provincial people rely on, because they don't like some of the environmental and social effects they have.
Do we have an issue, though, where a lot of trust, say, has been lost in resource extraction in New Zealand, especially by the companies that come from overseas, that we really need to set these things up when we don't have the infrastructure here in New Zealand, that they think, oh, well, New Zealand's hot and cold on this, we're going to come in, and 3 years, 6 years later, things get difficult and we get kicked out again. And a lot of these industries take, you know, maybe a decade or two to really reach their peak. They feel like they haven't got that
Investment certainty. Yeah, that's a legitimate
certainty. They need certainty, and they need to be able to trust that they're going to be able to get their value and live up to the contract that they've got. And when you have the opposition threatening to just pull the rug on them, then it becomes very difficult to really fulfill on the goal of doubling New Zealand's mineral export industry.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with you. I think that's a legitimate issue. You just have to power through. I mean, I think the best strategy is to power through, do the best you can to get them set up, get it embedded into the communities, have the local communities support it, and then that'll make it very costly if people want to remove that industry again from the community. There's no guarantees they won't try and do that. They probably will, but you have to make it as costly and painful as they can. Remember that the Labour Party was born on the West Coast in that mining area.
They've moved a long way since then.
They have. It's no longer really, I mean, this is another issue, but it's the Labour Party used to be the party of working people. And now they're not really they're the party of the woke. So although many of their policies still help working people economically, in a sort of cultural and social way, they sort of look down their noses and sneer at the culture and the way of life of ordinary working people. I mean, can you imagine some of the Labour Party people down in the local garage with the mechanic with the nudie calendar on the wall? I mean, that wouldn't go down well with them, would it?
Big cultural changes in the last 50 years, for sure. Now, one last government policy that we may have time to quickly go into, the Housing New Zealand, Kia Ngā Ora, if I'm pronouncing that right. I think they're renaming it to an English name, so I don't know which one we're supposed to use at the moment. Bill English did a big report into this total mismanagement of Housing New Zealand. The department itself seems to have kind of struck back at him, claiming that he's fudged the numbers and so on. But really, there are massive housing problems in New Zealand. We have still have a housing crisis. We have massive problems with people dependent on state housing, and an entire organization department that's basically in chaos and horribly mismanaged. Is the government going to pull that straight in any reasonable way, or?
Well, my view is this whole discussion around Kāinga misses the forest for the trees. The housing crisis is really an immigration crisis, right? I mean, we have a housing crisis because we have too many people and not enough houses. And the reason we have too many people is we have one of the highest immigration rates in the world. We're bringing in, you know, over 100,000 people net per year for the last several years. And there's just no way you can build that many houses that quickly if you're a country of 5 million people. And if you do try, it's going to take a lot of your capital out of other potential productive business uses into the housing market, which of course hurts the rest of your economy. So that's the real issue here. The housing crisis is really an immigration crisis. So you can reform Kāinga Ora as many times as you like, and I'm sure it is financially mismanaged. I have no reason to doubt that. Although there is a self-interested reason why the National Party might want to put the kibosh on Kāinga Ora, and that's because they want to move a lot of the social housing activity from a government department to community housing providers. And so they want, you know, organizations like the Salvation Army and a bunch of other organizations like that who aren't government owned and run. They want to give them money to provide more of these social housing spaces. And that, I mean, that's perfectly reasonable as far as I'm concerned. I'm sure a lot of those organizations do a better job than Kāinga Ora does. But yeah, you're never going to solve it just by reforming Kāinga Ora. So the plan, Chris Bishop's plan, is to build 1,500 new community homes, or maybe not even build them, maybe just make available 1,500 new community homes starting in 2025, I think. 1,500 isn't very many when you consider we're bringing in 100,000 people net per year. So it's a very small number. And so I just think it's a drop in the bucket. It's missing what the real problem is. And sure, reform it, but it's not going to do any good really in the long term until you fix the immigration problem.
And speaking of immigration, I think we can move into demographics just for a little bit. Quickly, we had a bunch of updates in the last week on fertility data. So basically the average number of of children that a woman in New Zealand has dropped from 1.6 down to 1.5 just in the last year. It's a pretty decent drop, I think. And also we've had the first census data, the 2023 census, revealed, basically just showing the demographic changes that have happened. And it's kind of the usual, what you might expect, aging population. There seems to be at least a growing population of Maori youth. So they you know, at least in terms of the birth rates as well, they're the only ones above replacement rate. And also immigration expectations, I guess, still see Asians expected to overtake Maori as the second largest ethnic group in New Zealand in about 10 years or so. I think 2040 is the expectation. And basically, Stats New Zealand is saying, hey, great, New Zealand is more diverse than ever. Meanwhile, the Ministry of Education is saying we're expecting 30,000 fewer children in the education system in the next decade. And you know, just to put things in perspective, the live births that we see in New Zealand are about 56,000. And if you compare that to 50 years ago, when we had half the population, the live births we were having were closer to 60,000 a year. So, you know, several thousand more births per year with just half the population. So we've had over 50% drop in the fertility rate in the last 50 years. And as you just mentioned, of course, immigration basically hiding the effects of that, but still the end result from the census is that we have an aging population problem. We have a shrinking number of children in New Zealand, just a shrinking number of, you know, children under the age of 10.
Well, I mean, how's that newfangled sex education going? Doesn't seem to be working. People don't know how to.
Well, I think the point of it, I think it is working in the sense that they don't really do that. So that to, you know, it's not about having children. It is fulfilling its purpose, but it's a subversive purpose.
Anyway, that's a bad joke. But yeah, look, the population's becoming less white, more diverse, slightly older. The Asian population is growing. The way that Stats New Zealand categorizes this isn't very good. Asian is a sort of a broad group that lumps Indian people in with Chinese and Japanese type people in with like the Pakistani type people. So it's a very broad category that covers ethnicities that really don't have a whole lot in common. But it's the fastest growing group. And there's a lot of people, a lot of different ethnicities in that Asian category, but the two main groups are Indians and Chinese, and they're growing very quickly. And yeah, they will overtake Maori soon. The Maori ethnicity is still the second largest by like 0.3 of a percentage point, but you know, so with, you know, it's not a very big difference, but it's going, the Asian group will overtake that, as you say, with you thought in the next 10 years. I eyeballed the numbers today. I thought it would be sooner than that, but I guess we'll see. There are a lot of problems with the way Stats New Zealand have done this census. First of all, they say the number of people in the country in March 2023, when they did the census, was just a tad under 5 million. Yet when you look at their estimate of the total population in New Zealand now, on the top of their website, when you open it up, it says 5.3 million. So that would mean we've gained 300,000 people in that time period, which is a lot of people in 1 year. You know, the net gain, we're told, is about 100,000 a year or slightly over. So where are all these extra people going? Why is there a discrepancy there?
And live births, I said, are only at 56,000. So you add those up and you're still only up to about 50% of the number that they.
And another really frustrating thing about this census is the way that they calculate the ethnicity data. Where people have reported more than one ethnicity, they've sort of double counted them. So when you add up all the percentages of the ethnicities, it sums to more than 100%. And that's because if you're part Maori and part European, say, you get counted twice. And so what this does is it makes it extraordinarily difficult, if not impossible, to really separate out who all the different ethnicities are. What they really should have done is had some sort of mixed category, so you could have sorted that out better. And the net effect is of doing it this way is it really disguises the level of white replacement that's going on with the immigration settings, because if you adjust for those mixed categories, I estimate that the amount of that the proportion of the white population has fallen below 60%, which would be that's quite a significant drop. And the numbers they're reporting are 67.8. So I think it's much lower than that.
I don't know how far back you'd have to go into the data. Probably not far. Like say in the 80s or so, you'd probably be looking at New Zealand being over 90% white. Basically, a big shift in immigration there. I think I've also seen it said that basically, like still close to 90% of New Zealand has some kind of European heritage. So I don't know how they're double counting or how they're counting, but maybe what I've heard is off. Maybe it has to be less than that now, like 80 or so. Or are we really looking at when they're giving the census data and they're saying 60, 67%, 70% with European background? Does that mean people who are putting in that they are at least part European? Is that how the census data is supposed to be reported?
Everyone who says, so the 67.8%, I think, is the number of people say they are at least part European on their ethnicity. Now, because it's relying on people to report what their ethnicity is, there may be people who have European ancestry or blood and they're not reporting it. They're using the term identify. So it's a bit like a transgender debate.
That is a key thing that I picked up while reading the data, saying, oh, we have the highest percentage of people who self-identify as Maori and who self-identify as European and so on. And I'm like, how is this even useful information? Like, maybe this would be useful if you were putting down a primary identity to say kind of like, okay, well, people, like you mentioned, if you give numbers that add up to 100%, where you say, okay, people have multiple ethnic backgrounds, but this is the one that they've put down as the one that they primarily identify with, then you have useful bits of data where you could tell more interesting story beyond just they've deliberately done this, but they've painted this picture. So New Zealand is more diverse, and that's the story. And so they've presented the data in such a way that they could put up these nice little graphics and little stories to say, oh, look at how diverse New Zealand is, and kind of to make that the focus about the wonders of diversity rather than giving accurate statistics.
Yeah, they could have reported the data in much better ways. Look, there's a lot of people who are part Maori and part European, and that's the biggest mixed category. That's the biggest category of overlap. However, there are other mixed categories who are, you know, have different combinations, but it's Maori-European mixed category that's the biggest one. And I know that from looking at previous census data where they did split that out into a separate category. So it's not like they can't do it, because they have done it before. They're just choosing not to do it anymore. However, in the future, you know, more detailed tables of this data may become available, and then I'll have a lot of fun diving into those and seeing what the real numbers are.
Yeah, I know that the numbers are something that you really enjoy going through. Pulling this back to a slightly more political matter, when I asked about the Maori Party early on in the recap of the week that we were doing, and part of their accusation about the Pākehā government, and say basically the accusation they're putting at ministers in the government is that they're acting white and they're not Maori. But actually, we have the most Maori ministers in the government ever. And like you mentioned, they tend to be viewed as acting too European. So is there like a big political issue here that you have going on with, I guess, how Maori want to identify, create, like the Maori Party sort of creating this two-class system almost, where you sort of have the Maori who are loyal to New Zealand and those who are loyal to the Maori Party and situations like that? Because how do these members of cabinet, how do they identify themselves, right? Like if Winston Peters is in the census, how is he identifying himself? How's David Seymour identifying himself in the census? And how are they treated in these figures for statistical purposes?
Well, I mean, you'd have to imagine that David Seymour, for example, would tick the Maori box and the European box. And the fact that someone like David Seymour can tick the Maori box shows you what that ethnicity category really means. Like he doesn't really seem that Maori, does he? I mean, I don't want to cast aspersions on him, and someone's going to come back and say, oh, that's a really horrible thing, you can't say that about him. But I mean, he doesn't really seem that Maori. But yes, you're right, this is the most Maori government that we've had. I think it's got the most Maori MPs and the most Maori cabinet ministers. And Winston Peters actually gave a blistering speech about this today, which I recommend everyone go and watch. They've posted it on social media. where he lambasts a Maori party, quite rightly, for being divisive. And he says, if you're, you know, if the races were reversed, you would be shut down in an instant. And he's completely correct about that. And then he goes on to say, well, look, I've been fighting for Maori for a long time. Where were you? What have you done? I mean, it's a fantastic speech. I'm not going to summarize it all here, but I recommend people go and have a look at it.
Well, thank you for that. And I guess the summary of that situation really is that New Zealanders on the whole have no real input into the demographic changes that are happening to New Zealand. And we just sort of get told about them in the stats and how wonderful they are. And there's never really a political conversation around what the future of New Zealand should look like and how policy should shape things. So we get told, oh, yes, the fertility rate is XYZ, and then that's just a deal with it. You know, here's the immigration numbers. You know, just deal with it right here. Here are all the statistics. Look at these numbers. And at the end of the day, there's sort of no political discussion to be had about it at all.
Well, we should have a population policy. It should be something that parties set out in their election manifestos. How many people do you want to bring in? What sort of people? Do you want them to be low-skilled, high-skilled? Where do you want to source them from? What's the language requirements you're going to put on them? Do you want them to speak English or not? And what do you want our population to be at a certain point in the future, 2050, 2100? How many people should we have here? What should the ethnic mix be? These are all questions that we ought to be able to debate and decide in the normal democratic manner that we do all other questions.
Well, that's all we have time for in this weekly wrap-up. I was going to ask about a few international questions, but they can always wait for another week when we have more time, because the international situations continue to develop. There's some interesting stuff happening in New Caledonia, and there's a big general election coming up in the UK. I think those issues can wait. And, well, this is all that we've had time for. I hope you've enjoyed it, and look forward to seeing how things develop in the next week. And then we'll speak with you again at the end of another week. So thank you for joining us, William. And to the listeners, please hang around. We've got a final end of the show coming up just after this break. And before you go, William, give people one last reminder as to where they can find you.
You can find me, William McGimsey, on Twitter or at TheZeitgeistNZ.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thank you for tuning in to RCR Reality Check Radio. If you like what you're listening to, dislike what you're listening to, either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057. That's 2057. Or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We would love to hear from you. So connect with us today.